This is our league, and this is your league. From the 55-yard line on CFL America Radio and the Sports History Network.
Welcome, everybody, to the new episode of Gridiron America. And I am sitting here today in Japan with my good friend, Joe Zimba. How you doing, my friend?
Well, Greg, it's always great to chat with you as well as to see you from so many miles away. And I think people can't see us, but I can explain behind Greg is an awesome display of NFL helmets, memorabilia, and everything that he needs to keep track of what's going on over here.
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything back there, including my action, my comic book action figures, the ones that my wife allowed me to bring over here. I'm a huge Shazam Captain Marvel fan, so you can there's a whole shelf devoted to that. I don't know if you can see that from here, but it's great seeing you. And the last time you and I saw each other was at, I forget which library it was, when you gave a lecture on the Bears and Cardinals, and you signed for me your book, I have it proudly displayed here, your newest book on the Bears and Cardinals, and that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about Cardinals stuff. So it's always a topic near and dear to my heart, and mm-hmm. I know it is to you. Obviously, you've written two books on the Cardinals. You've also written one book on the one place that, was the home of the Cardinals where they did their training camp too.
That's right. Yeah. The Morgan Park Military Academy, greatest high school football program that no one ever heard about in Chicago.
Hey, you know what? And it's funny you should mention that, because, I went to high school at one of the greatest high school one of the greatest high school football powerhouses in all of the state of Illinois, down at Bishop McNamara. But the whole story about Morgan Park is just, it's amazing. And also too, in addition to your work, doing your books, you are basically professor emeritus at the Sports History Network with your podcast, When Football Was Football. And you were also an instructor at the Football Learning Academy, which is run by our good friend Ken Crippen. So, and I know you just actually last night went on the Football Learning Academy myself and signed up for the two courses that you are the instructor of. And you got anything else coming out there soon?
We appreciate that. Yeah, thank you for that. I'm having fun with both of those activities, and of course, quite honored to participate with the Sports History Network and the Football Learning Academy. But we have a Chicago Cardinals page on Facebook, which we try and update on a regular basis with new information of old stuff. And I think I've told you before, Greg, I have no life. I search for Cardinal stuff every day. And if I can unturn some nugget and share it with people, I'm quite happy. But also starting to fool around with a couple other book titles on the Bears, Chicago Bears, and the Chicago Cardinals, which hopefully will be wrapped up later this year. So it's kind of nice in my old age of retirement to just spend about 100% of my time, although my wife's not real happy about it, researching old football guys. So it's been a lot of fun.
I get it. And I know your wife too. So, and she definitely, it was a pleasure meeting her too when I was at the library, when I saw you. Well, all the times I've seen you at your lectures, your wife's always been right there with you. And your wife's like my wife. Yeah, keeps us on the straight and narrow, and they don't mind the football stuff because they know what we're doing. They can see it, right? It's not like, it's not like we're, in our retirement, we're sitting at a bar somewhere, just,
Which football sounds pretty good too, though. Huh?
Yeah. And it's funny here in Japan, you know, when it comes to football, it somebody was asking me the other day, oh, yeah, you know, they were asking me about The Rock and the XFL. And it's like, oh, I'm sure. And I didn't want to burst anyone's bubble. But here in Japan, when it comes to gridiron football, nobody knows that there's even a gridiron league here. I mean, there's college football here and there's pro football. And, you know, from us being on Facebook with each other and seeing my pictures and everything, you know, I mean, there's football that goes on here. And when my wife and I and my brother-in-law, we went to the college football national championship here in December, there was that moment that I'm sitting there. And I'm just looking around. I'm like, must have been what it was like sitting in Wrigley Field, watching a football game at a baseball park, and not only a baseball park, but, you know, a historical ballpark. And even though, you know, it wasn't pro, but it was just, it had that feel. And the other part of it was nobody was sitting around me wearing anything with NFL properties. It looked like an old school football game where people just showed up in their street clothes, cheered on the team. You didn't have anybody wearing jerseys or anything. It was very much, it felt wonderful, actually. It's just, you know, because I've been to enough football games, and I know you have, where it's like you look at people wearing the jerseys, and sometimes you wonder, do you even know whose jersey you're wearing?
Right.
You even know, you know, I mean, like I went down to my first Cardinals game down in Arizona, and I've been to many Cardinals games before going on to see him at Glendale. I'm walking through, this is like hot, I mean, typical Phoenix day. It was like probably 300 degrees outside, but I'm walking through the parking lot, and I have some guy from way over in on the other end goes, is that a Tim Rosenbach jersey? I go, yes, it is. And I have a Johnny Johnson one at home. So yeah, no, it was really cool. Just doing that old school. It was a throwback game, and it was in a throwback setting. And that's what, you know, as you see behind me, you know, my shelf with my football stuff's kind of a shrine to the 70s, the era that I was a kid in. And I'm digressing here. So
no, but hey, you brought up what could be a good subject for someone to write a book is fan apparel through the centuries.
Oh yeah.
Got some photos of, say, from the 1890s at the University of Chicago when all the fans attended horse and buggy, and they were dressed to the hilt, very formal wear. And then you go even to the early NFL, everybody had a suit and tie on.
Yeah. For example,
when Red Grange showed up, and how that has changed over the years to the apparel. Now we just try and stay warm at some of these locations.
Oh, yeah. Well, talking about apparel and everything. So when we moved over here, I had to give up a lot of things, you know, personal possessions. Like, do I need this? But when it came to my NFL apparel stuff, that was kind of, it was a hard line there. So, a lot of my sweatshirts didn't make it. My Chicago Cardinals sweatshirts that I think I've worn to every one of the lectures I've been, those I had to part ways with, but that's okay. Cause I got to keep my Cardinals jackets, the jerseys that I love the most, all my Cardinals jerseys. And I think I've told you this before, when I grew up in the 70s as a 10-year-old kid in 77, I was a huge Bob Greasy fan. I was a huge Dolphins fan. And I don't know why, I think it came with Bob Greasy having the horn rim glasses and with the Cardinals connection. The first game I think I really paid attention to was that 1977 Thanksgiving Day game with the Dolphins and the Cardinals, and the Dolphins, you know, Bob Greasy threw for 6 touchdowns in that game. But that wasn't the most memorable part of the game. And there's a, I don't know if you can see it behind me, but there's a signed picture of Conrad Dobler behind me, who just recently passed away.
Yeah.
And if the most memorable part of that game was his ejection, and then after he got ejected, tossed his helmet in the stands. I don't know why I remember that was that. And I'm like, okay, then that was the game that kind of hooked me on the whole spectacle of pro football. And but yeah, and that's, I think, where I fell in love with Cardinal Byrd too. But it wasn't until Bob Gracie retired from the Dolphins that I started shifting my attention, you know, more southwest than southeast. And became a, now I'm obviously I'm a hardcore Arizona Cardinal fan. And while I grew up in Chicago, love the Bears, you know, I'm, you and I are both, you know, we grew up in an era where both the Cubs and Sox sucked. And so we could, you know, it's like, yeah, I don't, I root for both teams because, you know, I want, it's the city that I'm for, not so much the logo on the helmet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but anyway, it's nice having these conversations in Japan because I don't get to talk football as much. So going back to what I was saying about football in Japan. Yeah, no, we don't have really a pro. There's not a, the NFL is probably followed more closely by Japanese people than their own internal professional league, which is the X League, which, as you know, I do the Gridiron Japan podcast too. And, but it's interesting here, just talking about apparel. You do see a lot of NFL apparel here, even in the second.
Now that's quite interesting. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I was in a second NFL. I was in a secondhand shop a few weeks ago. We walk by and I see, of all things, an Edmonton Eskimos sweatshirt.
Oh.
I'm like, ooh. My wife's looking at me. She's like, yeah, don't you even think about it. So, well, this has an happy ending because by the time we left the mall, the Edmonton Eskimos sweatshirt went with me.
So, oh, no, that's a nice one.
Yeah. And, but yeah, I brought all my Cardinals stuff. I got my Cardinals hats. I got my Cardinals helmets. Got my mini helmets and everything. So it's, football is what kind of keeps me going here in terms of just, you know, my mornings. Obviously, we've got the XFL right now going and everything. So for me, Sunday night is Monday morning here. So this autumn coming up is going to be packed full of Gridiron football.
Yeah.
From morning, noon, and night, including watching the Japanese X League on, you know, during what would be normal hours, prime, you know, normal football hours back in the States. So,
well, that's great because we worry, your friends worry about you not getting your football fix. So I'm glad to hear that.
Well, that's the, you know what? If I moved here 30 years ago, like I had originally planned after I met my wife, that would have been hard because back 30, I mean, let's face it, what we're doing right now, the video interview and everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a crystal clear call. Everything here is science fiction, was science fiction 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, there's, you know, the only thing difference that has changed with my life, and hopefully I've got family and friends that are listening, is the fact that I'm just in a different time zone. I'm still connected, obviously, through social media. Mm-hmm. And the only one thing I don't have that I had back home was, you know, reasonably priced dairy products.
Yeah. Well,
the,
I think
the pizza here is pretty good. But I don't have a car right now. I've got a driver's license, but we have yet to buy a car. And it's been a fun adventure. And with the weather breaking and everything, it's going to be I'm looking forward to this spring and summer because we'll be doing a lot more traveling than even what we've done so far, which you've seen on the Facebook.
Oh, it'll be great. Hey, I was going to ask you, is there any one NFL team that seems to have popularity in Japan?
Well, if you go around, my unscientific observations have been the Green Bay Packers. I don't know why that is, but I've seen more Packers stuff floating through the malls than anything. And maybe it's the colors. I don't know. I got it. Next time we go to the mall, I'm going to have to spend a little bit more time in the secondhand shops. And, and on the baseball side of it, you don't see too much with Japanese professional baseball. And it obviously baseball here is a huge sport, but you see a lot of major league stuff. And I've seen more Sox fans here than I've seen Sox fans back home.
Oh,
just
geez.
Based upon the apparel itself. That's my.
Whoa.
So, but yeah, Cardinal stuff. Yeah. I haven't seen, I think I have the mother load of all Cardinals gear here. Yeah. So, well, talking about the Cardinals, we're digressing here. I get kind of long winded and it gets cathartic being able to do these kind of have these football talks. But talking about the Cardinals, we had an anniversary come that happened the other day that honestly, I'm happy did not go unnoticed by not only, well, it was nice to, and I listen to Dan Patrick every day. Even they brought it up, but the anniversary of the Cardinals leaving Chicago, and you are teaching a class on the Football Learning Academy now that talks about that. And there's a lot about the Cardinals moves that either is it the information that's been put out previously has been either fake or either false or embellished. There's a whole story that led to this decision that I wanted to sit down and just have you tell me and tell the audience, how did it come to be the Cardinals, our Cardinals left our hometown and made their way eventually down to what I like to term the far, far, far western suburbs of Glendale.
Yes. A very good description.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole move situation, there's so many layers of it. I think if you're not familiar with sports, but you're a fan and you hear that a team is moving, well, obviously it's for economic reasons. And that was one of the reasons why the Cardinals were looking. But underneath it all, and I really covered this quite deeply in my latest book about the rivalry between the Bears and the Cardinals, that George Hellas of the Bears really just could not wait to get rid of the Cardinals. They not only were defeating him during the 1950s when the Cardinals were not too good and the Bears were a little better, but there was just this fact that the Cardinals were sharing revenue with fans. And the biggest deal was, since Chicago was the only city with two NFL teams at the time and television was just starting to become popular, there was a very unique and weird rule called the blackout rule. And what that meant was that if the Cardinals were playing at home and the Bears were, say, in Detroit, the Bears were not allowed to televise their game back to Chicago, unless I think if there was a sellout or something, and for the Cardinals, which never happened in the 50s. So that was the one thing that was really heavily discussed at the time, was the blackout rule, that it hurt revenue for both the Bears and the Cardinals. And the other part was, with the Cardinals not drawing really well at Comiskey Park, the other teams weren't getting the guarantee that they'd like to get as a visiting team. In the 50s, it was a guarantee of $20,000 if, say, the Eagles came or the Steelers came to Comiskey Park to play the Cardinals. And the Cardinals really had a scrape to get that. Oftentimes, teams also had the opportunity to take a percentage of the gate. So if you went to the Bears instead of the Cardinals, say, yeah, I'll take that percentage, you could make a lot more than $20,000 as the visiting team. So the $20,000 might cover expenses to bring the entire team and the traveling party and the hotels and the transportation. But teams weren't for business, being professional. And so they wanted to earn a little bit more money. And as I think one of the owners of the Steelers said, that nobody ever made money when they came to play the Cardinals in the city. So there was a couple of reasons there. One was the blackout rule. The second was the revenue that wasn't being generated by the Cardinals. But the third major thing is, the Cardinals really would have liked to have looked around a little bit to play at a different stadium. And George Hellas kind of put a kibosh on that as well. The Cardinals in 1958 attempted to move to Dyke Stadium on the campus of Northwestern University. They felt they could draw a little more fans by playing up on the north side of Chicago. And there was some precedent for that as well. Back in 1931, now we're going back a few years before then, the Cardinals actually moved to Wrigley Field for their home games throughout the 30s. And the logic seemed quite simple. The owner of the Cardinals, whose name was Dr. David Jones, he was the city physician for the city of Chicago, not a man of great wealth to be owning a professional football team. He looked at the attendance for the Cardinals game on the south side compared to what the Bears are drawing on the north side, and he got this great idea. He said, I'll just move our games up to Wrigley Field. And the Cubs were glad to have another tenant as well. The problem for the Cardinals was, when you first dibs on dates goes to the Cubs, trying to finish the baseball season. And then the Bears got the second choice because they were the original tenants. And then the Cardinals got their home date choices later in the season. So often Cardinals wouldn't play a home game until the end of November. And so the experiment went on for a few years. The Bears fans never really picked up going to Cardinals games, and the Cardinals fans from the south side of Chicago, and you can compare this to the rivalry between the White Sox and the Cubs in baseball now. Right. Anyway, the south side Chicago Cardinals fans felt betrayed that the Cardinals would play their games up there, and they didn't attend the games as well. So,
yeah.
And for the 1940 season, Cardinals were back at Comiskey Park. But fast forwarding to 1958, as I mentioned, and everything seemed to be falling into place that the Cardinals could move to Dyke Stadium. The university, Northwestern University, was apparently very receptive to that. The Cardinals even went out and did a survey among the residents, and they thought it was okay to have football there on Sunday. So all they needed then was the approval of the National Football League. And that's where George Halas comes in, unfortunately. In the middle of all this talk about moving the team to Northwestern, everyone would be happy. Halas pulls out something called the Madison Street Agreement. And Madison Avenue is an east-west street in downtown Chicago. And apparently in 1931, Dr. Jones, the owner of the Cardinals, signed an agreement with Mr. Halas that said the Cardinals would not play any games north of Madison Street. The Bears, according to Halas, would not play any games south of Madison Street. They would divide the city in half. And so no one on the Cardinals by 1958 had ever heard of this agreement. No one had seen it. And Halas pulled it out, and he went to the NFL meeting, hoping to stop the Cardinals from what he considered a movement into his territory, which would be on the north side of Chicago. And Commissioner Bert Bell agreed with Halas. Said it was the toughest decision of his career, but he couldn't let the Cardinals move. And I remember one of the Cardinals managers said at the time, and this is kind of a well-known statement, he said, well, if we had been able to move to Dyke Stadium, we'd still be in Chicago. But unfortunately, that started the wheels turning. That was in late 58. And the Cardinals would move a couple of years later. But to end my story there briefly, that's kind of setting the table for the whole move.
Well, let me ask you, when it comes to stadiums, now you and I, for those who are listening that don't know, the Chicago area really is at a, you would think in a major metropolitan area like what we lived in and grew up in, that there'd be more than a few stadiums. But when it comes to, I mean, in terms of major colleges, the University of Chicago was a football powerhouse, mm-hmm. but obviously their program ended in the 30s, I think, was it?
Yeah, end 30s? Of the
30s. End of the 30s. Ended, so the stadium there was on its way out and was eventually torn down. And obviously we know what happened underneath the stands mm-hmm. that led to the atomic age that we now live in. But so you had Comiskey Park, which back then, I mean, even back then, Comiskey Park was an old park.
It was, yes.
It was. I mean, it was built, I think, in 1910. Double check my numbers, but yeah, it was an aging stadium then too. But and then you had Dyke Stadium, which, listen, for those people who have never been to Chicago, it's hard to explain just how hard it is to get to Evanston, even yes. from the city itself.
Yeah.
That is, I lived in the western suburbs for years, and that was at least an hour drive up Harlem Avenue and then over. Just not an easy stadium to get to, even with public transportation. But there was one stadium centrally located, and that's Soldier Field. And so my question is was Soldier, why did it take so long for Soldier Field to become an NFL stadium? Not only for the Bears, but also for the Cardinals.
Right. And that stadium was built, I believe, in 1924, and it hosted huge crowds. I think for 110,000 people attended a Notre Dame game there right after it opened. It also Army hosted Navy auto game. Races.
Army Navy game.
Yep, was, Army was Navy played there, and so, but it wasn't used. It hosted the Pan American Games in 1959, for example. But it was huge, and if you see it on television now, as the home of the Bears. It's not anywhere near the size it used to be. There was a north end, so they could fit this full track in there for athletic events as well as auto racing.
It truly was. I mean, it truly was an Olympic stadium.
It was.
I mean,
just a huge place.
You would compare Soldier Field as it was to what the LA Memorial Coliseum is.
That's a good example.
That
right?
type of grandeur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that huge place. But the Cardinals did move there in 1959. They played four of their six home games there. The city of Chicago agreed to make some improvements to the stadium so it would be more football friendly for the Cardinals. Although the team also played two games in Minneapolis that season. And looking around for a new home was nothing new for the Cardinals. I recall reading about they played their opener in 1940 in Buffalo, because they couldn't get Comiskey Park when they wanted it. And it seems to me there would have to be a better reason for that to make the schedule that you would be conflicting with the baseball team you're renting from. But there had been rumors over the years that they might go to Miami or they might go to Nashville, for example, even San Francisco or Los Angeles before the NFL extended their teams out that way. So it seemed like a logical move to go to Soldier Field, much easier to get to. We had Lakeshore Drive right outside it. It's much improved now, but there was parking around there. Now it's a little more difficult if you try and go to a Bears game at Soldier Field.
Right.
But it would seem to be a logical place. And one example I'm thinking of is what confused me through the years is back in 1934, the editor of the Chicago Tribune started the College Football All-Star Game, and that drew massive crowds. 101,000 saw the Cardinals play the All-Stars in 1948. And for those not familiar with the All-Star Game, since it hasn't been around since 1976, but each summer at Soldier Field, the college kids who had just graduated or used up their eligibility were voted upon from a nationwide survey or voting process using newspapers, and they would play the defending NFL champions. So it was a huge success right off the bat. The first game, the Bears and the All-Stars played to a 0-0 tie, but some of the newspapers at that time were talking about traffic jams, which were unheard of at that time around a football field for the pros. And so it worked.
And back
really
then,
well.
Lakeshore Drive was like the main way to get into the city.
It was, yeah.
One of the main ways. I mean, nowadays, mm-hmm. obviously, they're different ways. So I can only imagine. I know what those traffic jams on Lakeshore Drive are during a normal day. I can only imagine what they would have been like back during that time period.
Yeah. And they even played night games for the All-Stars way back then. So that was just shortly after, I think, the Cardinals played the first night game in the NFL in 1929 or so. So it was quite the event, and it would seem logical that the Cardinals could have played there years and years before they did, but for some reason they didn't. Maybe the rent was too high. I'm not sure. But
and we both know how. I mean, that is owned by the Chicago Park District.
So we know.
I mean, we just know with current history with the Bears right now how ever since I think 1971, the Bears have called Soldier Field home. Mm-hmm. And anybody who is from Chicago, anybody who's a Bears fan knows what the history, the Bears in the Park District, it was always an uneasy relationship from day one. And now, I mean, obviously we're looking at full blown divorce here with Arlington Heights and everything.
Right.
So
yes.
we can take what we know from here in the recent history and kind of extrapolate as to what that back then. Yeah. I mean, it's not surprising that the Cardinals didn't play at Soldier Field, mm-hmm. but that was always a thing, before I really got into sports history and football history, really reading up on it. And again, I read, your first book, When Football Was Football, and you go into great depth with your book as to not only the names of the players, the owners and everything, but also where they play. There's a whole section of your book devoted at the very end as to the schedules and where they played. And the one thing that stood out with me in your book and looking at those records is how little it seemed like the Cardinals were, seemed like they were permanently on the road most of the season.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there were some seasons, correct me if I'm wrong, but they only played two or three home games.
They did. And that contrasted greatly with the early 1920s when one or two seasons the Cardinals never left town. They would have, say, eight or nine home games, and then they'd play the Bears in Chicago, so they would never leave Chicago. And then towards the end of the 20s, I think about 1928, they had a very strange schedule where they were out of town almost every week. And then, of course, in the 30s, moving to Wrigley Field, they didn't have the opportunity to play home games when the nice weather was out in September. With, as I mentioned, the first home game taking place in November, late November sometime. So it was a problem. And you go back when we mentioned the Chicago Park District, I just recently found out kind of a fun story about how tough they were on these teams. Charles Bidwell, who owned the Bears, and this, excuse me, owned the Cardinals. He was an owner of the Bears too, but who owned the Cardinals for many years, and his family still owns it. He constructed a stadium on the south side of Chicago called Bidwell Stadium, and he opened it up for free to all the different softball teams, including a professional women's team.
I did not know
and
that.
And every year they would have charity games where you'd say pay $2 or $3 to enter the game, and all that money would be given to charity. And so Bidwell was really well known for his charitable efforts at the time. When he passed away in early 1947, and a couple of years later, another company took it over, and the Park District eventually condemned the land so they could own the stadium. Mm. And so some of the folks who had raised thousands of dollars for charity went to the Park District to get approval to play this all-star event at what was Bidwell Stadium. And the Park District turned them down because it said, we can't and allow anybody to charge admission on a Park District facility. So they essentially wiped out the entire charitable events that took place there.
Wow.
And so that's why I'm saying maybe getting the Cardinals to rent Soldier Field wasn't as easy as they thought it
yeah.
was.
Yeah. Yeah. Now hearing that state, and that all makes sense actually to me. I'm like, Okay, now I understand. Because eminent domain, I don't know for those who are familiar, at least in Illinois, I mean, eminent domain is told to me by the state, as explained to me by the state's attorney down there in Will County. Yeah. The government can pretty much take what it wants. Mm-hmm. By eminent domain, and that is a good example, perfect example of what, you know, what Illinois Chicago politics kind of has always been about. And so let me ask you, when it comes to, let's talk Charlie Bidwell, because mm-hmm. there's to me it's always been the greatest what if. And I say this because over the summer, and you probably saw the pictures of me and Randy Snow with the mm-hmm. World Football Podcast. Randy likes to go visit the graves of famous individuals, famous football individuals. And so as part of our journey over a course of two days, we took actually right down the street from where, not too far from where I lived, the graves of Charlie and Violet Bidwell.
Yeah.
They're in Hillside at the mausoleum. And so when I was there, Randy and I were having this discussion. What if he would not have, what, let's just say hypothetically, medical science was able to save him and he survived what he died from. How different would the Cardinals' history have been, do you think?
Ooh, boy. That is a great question. And for a couple of reasons. One, he disproved the notion that the Cardinals were not willing to spend money. He spent a lot of money, for example, recruiting and signing Charlie Trippi in early 1947 before he passed.
Right.
And the other thing that was always interesting is he was good friends with George Halas. He had owned a share of the Bears before he took over the Cardinals. And so I think so much acrimony came out, and I might even call it hate, between Walter Wolfner, who married Charlie Bidwell's widow,
right,
he's not a football man. And I still would think that if Charles Bidwell was there, the Cardinals might still be in Chicago. Wolfner was from St. Louis. He just seemed to aggravate everybody. The team that won the championship in 47 was virtually disintegrated within a year or so.
Yeah.
And we hear stories about how Jimmy Councilman, the coach, couldn't stand Wolfner, so he left. Even Curly Lambeau, the surprise selection in 1950 as a coach, he didn't last 2 years because supposedly of Wolfner. And even there was a president of the team that was a football man who left the Cardinals because apparently he couldn't get along with Walter Wolfner. So I think if Charles Bidwell was still around, we might still have the Cardinals on the south side. He may have jumped in and earlier worked deals because he knew everybody. Who knows?
And you could even extrapolate too, because at some point, the Bears and Cardinals would have had to work together towards a new stadium.
Yeah. Yeah.
Knowing what we see out in LA and what we see out in New Jersey, you don't have to imagine too hard that's what would have happened in Chicago. There might be a stadium already out in Arlington Heights where two teams are playing right now.
Yeah, they could be. But if you think of another thing, Bidwell was also operating two horse racetracks.
Yeah.
Hawthorne and Sportsman. Sportsman eventually turned into an auto racing track for Indy cars.
Right.
Could he have taken one of those and remodeled it for a football team? The guy was very active and very creative.
Yeah, I forgot about the property he owned, but about the parks.
Or he could have just, at the time, there was plenty of vacant land around the city that he may have gone ahead and just built his own stadium as well.
Right. And so talking about that and talking about, so he passed away and 2 years later, Violet remarries.
Mm-hmm.
Now the relationship, now that to me has always been kind of the key turning point for that franchise is when Charlie Bidwell died. Everything kind of turned for the franchise. Like you said, that championship team was pretty much, they went back to the championship in 48 and lost by a touchdown to the Eagles. And after that, never sniffed anything in terms of winning for quite a long while. So what was the relationship at that point? So when he died after that, so when Wolfner came in, it seemed to me, everything that I've read with your book and in other books, the team was operating on a shoestring, constantly on a loss, but it was a loss that was absorbable. I mean, they lost money, it seemed like, every year, but the losses weren't horrible, and they could survive the losses by borrowing, using money from other ventures to kind of supplement. But how much of a mom and pop operation was it, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask. Because you've looked at the numbers, and you've been to the Pro Football Hall of Fame and looked at a lot of documents. So I ask that somebody who's witnessed in a way, kind of witnessed history firsthand through all your research.
Yeah, and that part is always fun. But yeah, Bidwell was a good manager, in my opinion. He ran a whole umbrella of different companies, from the racetracks to dog tracks to his printing company, which sold programs and tickets for everybody in the area. So he was making a good living, and he wasn't afraid to get involved as well. He was proactive, for example, with the softball leagues. He started the softball team called the Bluebirds in Chicago for women's softball. And he opened the doors for women to be professionals during World War II. And so he's the kind of guy, I think, was such a go-getter, and he was still so young, in his early 50s, I believe, when he passed away, that he always was thinking of a way not only to, let's say, make a buck, but also to have fun doing it. In fact, someone asked him, "You're losing money on the Cardinals or on this and that." And he'd said, "Well, what's the fun of having all this money if you can't spend it?" So I always thought that was a neat quote for him as a manager, that, as you just said, he always seemed to have the ability to, shall we say, rob Peter to pay Paul. And rob is too strong a word, but you know, from one of the other companies might hold the Cardinals off until they could get the attendance in. And
yeah,
you know, the Bears had the same problem in the 30s. Right. George Halas had IOUs out to his coaches and to his players like Bonko Nagurski, and paid them off in notes with interest when they started getting money in from attendance. And so that's why football being televised was so important in the 50s. And Halas was one of the first to jump in, starting his own little network in the early 50s. Even though Halas in the late 40s once said, and I probably told you this, he said, "Bah, who's going to watch television? They're going to sit around your living room and watch a game on a little box. It'll never be popular." And of course, 109 million people watch the Super Bowl every year. So I guess he was wrong on that. But he did have the intent to start his own television network. He saw where this might be helpful. And I think the Cardinals might have been involved in that early too. And Chicago being a huge market, there's no reason why both of those clubs couldn't have been more economically happy than the Cardinals were.
Well, when you say television network, what was that? I mean, explain, because this is something, I mean, I've heard about, but I really never, I don't really know a whole lot about. So when the Bears started their own little network, were they broadcasting, for lack of a better, were they like the Cubs and broadcasting on WGN? And
yeah,
how did that work?
From what I understand, Halas was able to put together different stations that would cover the Bears, and they would share in the advertising, which wasn't phenomenal at the time.
Right.
But knowing Halas, he may have gotten a piece of every television set that was sold in Chicago too.
Yeah. But that's a good point.
Literally put together a network of stations in the Midwest that would be able to watch the Bears games and therefore increase the popularity of the team. Okay. And hopefully people then would come by and invest their money for a ticket to watch the team. And of course, things are so much different then. There just wasn't much revenue coming in. You had your ticket sales and your program sales for many, many years in the NFL. And so knowing that Halas had this unusual vision that after briefly saying it wouldn't work, he certainly really pushed television in the early 50s.
And was it a net? And I'm probably going to ask you a whole lot of questions on this. So I'm going to apologize in advance, because now the old probation officer in me is starting to spin up questions like I would always do when I was doing a case. So with this television network, was it outside the Chicago or was it within Chicago? Basically, I guess what I'm asking is, did they televise home games and away games in the Chicago market?
Yeah, I think it was all home games that were televised outside of Chicago, going as far as South Bend or, say, Beloit, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And I'm thinking there was one or possibly two channels in Chicago. WBKB, which is now Channel 2, was one in Chicago that televised the Bears game. So it wasn't, from my understanding, and I haven't done a great deal of research, but it just struck me as something quite interesting that Halas had this vision to put together different television stations. And radio broadcasting wasn't that old either at the time. So they were doing that on WGN going back to the early 20s, especially when Red Grange had his first game. There was two or three radio stations that were covering that game.
And
so seeing a little bit how the revenue might be there eventually. As I mentioned, we traditionally saw ticket sales, program sales, but now we had the electronic, which is a strong word for the time, media coming in and getting some sales out of that as well.
Yeah. And, you know, back then, you know, up until, you know, through my childhood, you know, and over the air antenna TV was the main way you watched everything. I mean, you know, people talk about streaming nowadays and how ubiquitous it is, and nobody's watching cable subscribers are going down, but over the air free TV has always been a staple everywhere, not just in America.
Yeah.
I cut the cord here in Japan and I can watch all my Tokyo Giants games free. The Tokyo Giants here, it's funny. I'm digressing just a little bit, so bear with me. They're basically, you know what, when I watch Tokyo Giants here, it reminds me of watching the Cubs on WGN.
Ah.
They're ubiquitous. It's like, boom, Giants are on. And, you know, going back to the Bears, they had the, George Halas had the foresight to at least attempt something like that. But there was another, as the 50s wore on, there was also the talk, the push for expansion. Mm-hmm. Because the NFL, for those who don't know, who are listening to this and you know, don't really know football history, people forget that the NFL consisted pretty much of 12 teams for a good part of its history through the 1950s. Am I right on the number? Because I'm like,
I'm going to assume you are, but okay. Yes.
Because it's, I always sit down, because when I tell people, you know, I always try to prove how, you know, I hate saying this, how old I am. I go, you have to remember, I was born at a time when Lombardi coached the Packers and there were 12 NFL teams. And I get this look like, what? So, but back then you had the NFL. The NFL was an old boys club, including the Bidwells. The Bidwells, mm-hmm. you know, they were, not that they were founding members, but they had been with the NFL, much like with the Rooneys and everything. They were part of that, all the traditional families that, and for a lot of the teams are still with us. I mean, the Gaskys, yeah. the Rooneys, the Bidwells. I mean, those three families right there. And unfortunately, the Bells are not part of that. And you and I are both friends with Upton. And,
right.
And Upton tells a story about how, you know, fate intervened that him and his brother weren't able to own the Eagles because of his father's untimely passing.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to push for people were clamoring for expansion. The 1950s, it was post-war America. Things were changing. America, but the NFL didn't want to expand. And in your research during that time period, aside the Cardinals, it seemed like everybody wanted to buy the Cardinals. Mm-hmm. And so the Bidwells didn't want to sell. And what was the reasoning? Who was the person behind saying we're not going to sell the team? Was it Violet or was it Wolfner?
Yeah, that was Wolfner. In fact, even that, if we bring our story back to the Cardinals leaving there, Wolfner was adamant, even in the early 50s, that saying we're not leaving Chicago. And even when the move was announced on March 13th of 1960, 3 days before he was denying it, 2 days before he was denying it, the day of it, he was denying that they had any plans to move. So that's, I think, why it was so harsh a decision for the fans who kept up hope that the Cardinals would still be there. So it was Walter Wolfner. Yeah.
Okay. And so, like, with the events that led up to it, now we know in the 50s, towards the end of the 50s, you know, the Cardinals shifted over to Soldier Field. And why did they shift to Soldier Field? How did that come about, that season they played in Soldier Field?
There's two stories I heard. One was the White Sox were not interested in sharing the field any longer. White Sox had good teams there in the 50s.
And 59 was the year they went to the World Series.
Won the pennant. Yeah. So there was that fear of a football team being in there and destroying the grass, etc. And the other that was that the Cardinals, after being turned down for Dyke Stadium, really wanted to test the grounds, maybe finally seeing if there was some place where they could attract more fans, Soldier Field being a logical move. But of course, as I mentioned, they played two games in Minneapolis as well that didn't really draw that well. They only drew about 20,000 people each, but it was still a time of experimentation until the denials kept getting stronger and stronger from Wolfner. And I guess when someone denies something that much, you wonder, well, what is really going on here?
Right. But there was one individual, there are actually two individuals that really pushed for to buy the Cardinals. Mm-hmm. And so you're talking Bud Adams and Lamar Hunt.
Yep. Yep.
And I always wonder, I always like doing, again, I go back to the what if questions. What if the Cardinals were now known either as the Houston Cardinals or the Dallas Cardinals?
Hmm.
How different our reality would look.
Yeah, yeah.
Just on the sports, just on when it comes to sports. would we have, I mean, I think we, the NFL would have expanded, just, you know, knowing where we're at now here in the 21st century, but just the whole landscape of sports would have been so completely different had the Cardinals moved to Dallas or Houston. Yeah.
And of course, we've all heard the story that when Lamar Hunt apparently couldn't buy the Cardinals, he decided to start this competing league called the AFL. And it was logical for the Cardinals to go to St. Louis so the AFL wouldn't get a foothold in St.
Right. And that's what this kind of, it's always been the story I've heard. Well, that's the AFL is the reason why the Cardinals went to St. Louis. But was that the case, do you think?
I think that the case was Wolfner wanted to get as big a payday as he could by moving the team. And the attendance had been pretty lousy, except when the Bears played against the Cardinals at Soldier Field, or excuse me, at Comiskey Park. Their attendance was really horrible. I think in 59, only 10,000 showed up for a game with the Steelers. So it would be this stuff, and we hear of Wolfner denying it even the day of the announcement. This stuff had been going on for months. You just don't move an entire NFL team.
Oh, right.
So my opinion, of course, but and it must have been a nice incentive for the Cardinals to pick up and move to St. Louis. And everyone says it was just about television, and I agree with that too. But when you throw in $500,000 back in 1960, and a lot of that supplied by George Ellis of the Bears, it makes for intriguing possibilities as we consider what might or might not have happened. But, you know, what if Hunt had bought in the Cardinals with his apparent lots and lots of money? How would the NFL look differently? Where would he have moved the team? Would the AFL never have occurred? Would we not have Joe Namath promising to win?
And we wouldn't have America's team.
Yes, right.
We wouldn't have.
Would they have been here even? So
it's, I mean, it's always, I like doing, and that's the great thing about sports history is when I sit here, I'm like, okay, well, what if? I mean, I talked to Tim Hanlon the other, was it last week now, with Good Seats Still Available. And when I listen to his podcast about the leagues and teams that have passed, it's like, man, history would have twisted just a little bit. Where would we be at today, whether it be baseball or basketball? But, you know, obviously, you and I were huge gridiron football fans and the whole football aspect. And I think, honestly, I can't even imagine a reality where the Dallas Cowboys don't exist, where, you know, 32 NFL team league doesn't exist.
Yes.
And you just all the possibility, I mean, there would have been no AFL. You would have still had Lombardi. You would have still had those great Lombardi teams, but no Joe Namath. You would have had Joe Namath. He might've been playing for the Cardinals for all we
know. He got drafted by the Cardinals.
So it makes for a lot of interesting what ifs. But when it comes to the Bears and the Cardinals history, it is very much a joined history. And what are some things that people don't realize that joins the Bears and the Cardinals, aside from the fact that they're both the original founding members? Are there some other tidbits of trivia here that a lot of people wouldn't know unless they read your book? And without giving the whole book away, is there anything you can share? You get anything you can share there people wouldn't necessarily know just by looking at stuff on the internet?
Yeah, a lot of the stuff that we include in the book, of course, has not been seen by the internet. Of course, we all know that the Bears and the Cardinals are the only two original NFL members that are still in existence. The fact that they shared early radio station coverage in Chicago, which was interesting. They shared Wrigley Field, as we talked about earlier.
I did not know it. Well, I mean, I've read your book, but had I not read the book, I would have not known about the radio.
And the fact that they really made Chicago the heartbeat of the National Football League when they played twice a year and they drew big crowds, and the rivalry and the stories of the story I've told before about the Al Capone mob breaking up one of the games between the Bears and the Cardinals when a fight broke out on the field and the fans came onto the field, the police came onto the field, and all sorts of fun stuff was going on. And looking back, and one of the neatest things that I've been able to find, which I base a lot of my book on, is at the Hall of Fame now has released the Dutch Sternemann papers,
right,
which Dutch was the co-owner of the Bears in the 1920s and very early 1930s. And his family maintained all of his records. So Hallis took care of the football stuff. Sternemann was the co-coach and co-owner, but Sternemann did the finances. And that stuff has just been, whoa, eye-popping. Yeah. To see what's happened with the actual holding in my hand, the documents that state how much each team made when Red Grange played his first game in 1925.
I have been to many of your lectures and you've shown that document on the screen, and it is a all the documents you show are fascinating, but yeah, that is one of the ones where you're like, oh, wow. And then, you know, unless you're an expert in finance and can figure out what those numbers mean in today's dollars, they don't seem at first glance, but then when you look like, oh, but yeah, back then it just, the teams operated so much on a shoestring. It was very, you know, almost all the NFL itself really up until the 1960s was, you know, it operated on a day-to-day basis. It seemed like. There was, you know, you had teams folding. I mean, up until the last team that actually folded, I think, was the Dallas Texans. NFL Dallas Texans was the last team, NFL team that I think actually folded, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it comes to that time period in the 50s, going back to little things like even logos on helmets. So when the Bears. Right, so up until the Colts were the Colts and the Rams were one of the, you know, talking. I do love football aesthetics, and I'm very much a fashionista when it comes to football. That's the reason why I'm a huge Cardinals fan. I love the old bird. Not a big fan of the new one, the one that they currently have, but it is what it is. But the parakeet on the helmet, you know, for when I was growing up is. And also, too, with the way the Dolphins logo was and the Bears, just something about it. I can't even explain why or how. But when the Cardinals were in Chicago, when they made the change to St. Louis, they went to Sportsman's Park. And they obviously, that's the year that they slapped the logo on the helmet. And to me, that's always been kind of the birth of the modern NFL. When you teams started, you know, paying attention to like NFL properties, NFL films came along not too much, right about that time too. So, you know, without NFL films, you might agree with me, you might disagree with me, but I don't think without NFL films, the NFL would be as popular as it is now.
Mm. They brought a little bit of poetry to a very difficult and challenging game, that's for sure.
Yeah, and it's something you don't see. I mean, the NFL films that we grew up with, that we know, is not the same NFL films that we see on the NFL Network now. Mm-hmm. We get glimpses of it every now and then for old specials. And thank God for YouTube. Thank God for on-demand stuff. And even the NFL Network has got some of the old stuff and everything. So going back to when the Cardinals left Chicago, they went to Sportsman's Park. What was it like in Chicago? Was it just like, boom, they're gone? I mean, was there an outcry? It wasn't like what you saw in Cleveland when the Browns left even in Houston when the Oilers left. What was it? Was it just kind of like a shrug from the city?
It was shock. I think a lot of shock, mainly because Wolfner kept saying there's no chance the team is going to leave. And people thought, yes, there is a chance. But in the talks I give around Chicago, and people still are saying, yeah, my dad or my grandfather was a fan and he was so upset. Now he follows the Bears or he follows the Packers or he still follows the Cardinals.
And well, so you know, anytime the Packers lose, an angel gets its wings. And we both know that, both being a Cardinals and Bears fan, anytime both our teams beat the Packers, an angel gets its wings.
That's a good day. Yeah. So there's a lot of dismay, a lot of disbelief in the newspapers as well. Pretty much were against Wolfner for this. But it's hard to say. There's so much stuff going on behind the scenes, the finances, and I think it would have been a lot cleaner if he had just not spent so much time denying it. Every paper around the country that I tried to look at, and they're from Tampa and Minnesota and New York, and Wolfner being on the wire service is saying,
right,
we're not going to move. We're still the Chicago Cardinals. Even on the morning the sale was announced, there's an article saying we're not moving.
It reminds me of Robert Irsay moving the Colts.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, except, you know, no alcohol involved.
Yeah, right.
If you remember those videos of Irsay at the airport denying the Colts were going to move, and not too much later, they were gone.
In the heat of the night.
Yeah. And but with the Chicago media was, I mean, what, you know, it seems like it, and maybe you'll agree with me, and I think you will, but when it comes to the South Side of Chicago, the teams on the South Side to me have always kind of gotten a short shrift.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember way back when, in what, the late 80s, early 90s, Sox were talking about moving if they wouldn't have got a new stadium.
Yeah.
And they got a new stadium. But we would never, but the, nobody's, you know, there's always that talk about, well, if the Bears, you know, the Bears are obviously moving to Arlington Heights, but they're not leaving Chicago. And we know, but the Bears are going to Arlington Heights, but they're still going to be the Chicago Bears. The Cubs are never going to leave Chicago. And if the Cubs ever did, the outcry would be, but, and just reading it, just, I never got a sense that, yes, there was people that were upset, but there was never an outcry that, like you would see now, if a team just up and moved, much like the Browns did, or even the Oilers did, and even with the Raiders. So, but that was the first big move too for the NFL, the first major relocation, and that's something people don't really talk about.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, and I agree with you when you said there wasn't a lot of concern because it quickly became old news in Chicago.
Right.
The Cardinals are gone. Oh, well, we still have the Bears, and the Bears are more popular.
Right.
We can get behind them. So I think how quickly that it was not a front page story said a lot about the Cardinals' move. And even the fact that when they moved, some of the, and there was a lot of newspapers in town then, didn't really cover that too deeply. The Tribune did, of course, and I think the Daily News and the Sun-Times, but it wasn't a great deal of coverage, nor was there a lot of hand-wringing and saying, oh, woe is us, we lost our team. Well, they're gone.
Well, and also, too, nobody was demanding a new public stadium, too, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a demand that I don't recall ever reading anything about it, but were the Cardinals demanding that the city pay for a new stadium, or
they seem to have kind of thrown the towel in when Hallis defeated them on Dyke Stadium going to Northwestern. Yeah. But they did. Here's an interesting thing about all that. The Cardinals went into an agreement with the city of Chicago to remodel Soldier Field, and the Cardinals were going to pay or split the costs with the city. And when they left, that was one of the stumbling blocks because the city wanted its money. And also right before the sale was announced, Wolfner got in the newspaper and said that in 1960, all of our home games are going back to Comiskey Park. Well, he's already under contract to Soldier Field. And it just seemed if he knew they were going to move to St. Louis, why he would say they're going to play all their home games in Comiskey Park.
Yeah.
So again, more confusion. I think his actions really turned off a lot of the media and the fans.
Well, and I could see where they would, because at that point, credibility, you know, and back then, all people knew was what they read the newspapers, what they saw on TV, and what they heard on the radio. They didn't have what we've got now. So if the newspapers were, you know, I can definitely see why it would be old news and it'd be on to it. And, but yeah, the credibility, when Irsay moved the Colts, there was a huge outcry. And we remember when all that happened, but they would keep replaying what Irsay said over and over, you know? So it's, but back then we didn't have that, you know, there wasn't that videotape of, it was just what you had in the paper. And like you said, everything moved on. There wasn't a rehash of the past. So, and
nor
real
did
quick,
we have negative reporting from the media, nor did we have the ability on social media for 8 million individuals to voice their opinion on this.
Exactly. Which is, you know, in some ways good, some ways bad. So it's always, you know, and you and I both know Twitter and social media is a double-edged sword. So, yeah, I could only imagine if that would have happened today. And so now here we are. And the Cardinals being in St. Louis, that's a whole nother chapter that, and I know that even though I know you're, you know, huge, you're not writing it. Your research has never been, it's always ventured. You've always had a little carryover into the St. Louis years, but your focus has always been as when the Cardinals have been in Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, obviously your dad was under contract with the Cardinals.
Exactly,
and that's how, that's what generated, that's what got you to where you are today. Being, like I said, the professor emeritus with the Sports History Network. And amongst the Professional Football Researchers Association, you know, you and other guys like Ken Crippen keep, keep the football history, the pro football history spirit alive. Cause it, and it's one of those subjects that just, you know, like you said, you do this all the time. I've noticed in my retirement, that's all I do is I kind of eat and sleep football, it seems like, and I do enjoy it. So, well, before I let you go here, before we end, now you and I, even though we're going to hit the stop button, I got a whole nother idea that I want to talk to you
after
the recording stops. But let everybody know where they can find you on social media, and also more importantly, where they can find your book, because it's available on, the new book's available paperback. Do you have, I can't remember, do you have audiobook?
No, not yet. No.
Okay. Well, but it is available on Kindle,
though. There's a Kindle
available
version.
On Kindle. Mm-hmm. So where can everybody find you?
Yeah, I think the easiest spot is a couple ways, right through McFarland Publishing on their website. Also, of course, Amazon, but the websites for, say, Target or Barnes & Noble also would have the book. And it's in paperback as well as an e-version, which is about half the price, I think. So also on social media, we're on Twitter at Shy Cards. And then on our Facebook site is Chicago Cardinals. And what else is there? But yeah, those are the main places to reach us. And I always, my email is on there too. We will respond to everybody who writes in and have questions about the Cardinals back when they're in Chicago. And that's always a lot of fun because we'll get notes from people whose, say, grandfather, great-grandfather played for the Cardinals. And it was really nice this past fall. I did, I think, 20 talks to promote the book. And you were at a couple of them and managed to stay awake. So I'm always grateful.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you before we finally wrap up here. Are you, I know you're, are you doing any upcoming talks, say, down where you're at right now? I know you've been floating around the Arizona, floating around Arizona doing giving talks. Any more planned down there?
Well, a couple that we, one we did in Mesa at the Mesa Library, then we'll be in Ventana Canyon, but I'm not sure when we are going to release this portion of the talk, but that's I think March 20th.
Oh, this thing's going out later on tonight after after I take care, after I spend my day outside working in the yard here. It's a sunny day here in southwestern Japan. But are you planning on being back in Phoenix anytime soon, like the Mesa area? Because I've got, I know, and I'm gonna give a shout out to my aunt and uncle who live in Mesa. I don't think they were at your, they would have said something, but they didn't, they weren't able to make it to your last talk in Mesa. Are you going to be going back to Mesa anytime soon?
Yeah, not probably till early next year. I think we will be back, but wrapping up my time here. And we want to thank everybody who came to that Mesa presentation, a lot of people, and we had some great questions, and it's nice to see fans interested in NFL history, and particularly the Cardinals history back when they were in Chicago.
Well, and the great thing about out where you're at and in Arizona, like at the very beginning, I said, you know, it's a far, far, far western suburbs of Chicago, because they got everything. It's like, hey, there's a Portillo. When I was down there for reserve duty for the 4 years I spent down there, somebody's like, oh, you're from Chicago? We got a Portillo's down here. You want to go to Portillo's? I go, I got a Portillo's literally like a block down from my house. I don't need to do Portillo's in Phoenix. I had other good places that I like. Fate's Brewery over there on Scottsdale Road is always, if you've not been there, it's a great place to go. No, so next time you're in Scottsdale, Scottsdale and McDowell, it's one of my favorite places. So, well, hey, listen, my friend, it is good talking with you today. You definitely have made my day. It's always good when I'm sitting here in southwestern Japan talking football to my friends far away on the other side of the world. And again, the great thing is, it doesn't feel like I'm on the other side of the world.
No, this is great.
Yeah, and we will definitely do more of this because, like I said, I've got an idea that I've kicked around with our fellow Sports History Network podcasters that I want to talk to you about and have a meeting on and figure out how we can incorporate some technology into some future podcasts.
Oh, good.
Which I'll explain about. So, but for everybody listening, thank you very much. And believe me, you're going to be hearing from me pretty soon because I've got quite a few guests lined up here for Gridiron America here from the 55 yard line on the Sports History Network. And the reason why I'm doing these kind of solo is with the time change and everything, my buddy Scott, not always able to line up our times. And, Scott, I always tell people that are listening, Scott is still here. Scott and I have not divorced, but it's just a matter of just lining up things with his life there and with my life here. Scott's doing well, and hopefully you're going to be hearing from him sooner rather than later. So with all that said, hey, if you're looking for me on social media, you can find me at CFL America. I'm also at XFL America, where I've got the XFL InfoWars show. And if you're watching XFL football right now, which I'm going to be honest with you, I'm enjoying watching, but it is the third version of the XFL. And if you had a chance, I just recently interviewed Brett Forrest, who wrote the history book on the first XFL, which was a very, it was an enjoyable interview, and that's another great book out there. Joe, you haven't read that book yet, right?
I have not, but now you've got me anxious to look for it.
Yeah, just re-released too on Kindle, and it is truly, it's one of those books where you just like, and then 4 hours later you're midway through, almost done with it. It's a phenomenal read. And and with that said, real quickly before I let you go here, you working on any books coming out?
There's two I'm working on. One will have to do with the Chicago Bears in the 1940s. And it would be focusing on how one team won four NFL titles in a 6 year period. And then a few years, we're coming up to 1925, which in my opinion is the craziest year in NFL history. So there might be a book on that as well, Greg.
Nice. I know where you're alluding to too. So, and I will say, I'll leave that there with that. I won't give away the spoiler on that. So, all right. Well, listen, on behalf of myself and Joe Zimba, thank you for listening. And I shall be talking with you, or we shall all be talking with you very, very soon. Check out Joe's podcast, When Football Was Football, on the Sports History Network. And thank you for listening.
This is Billy Stacy of the St. Louis Football Cardinals, and the Cardinals are charging.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.